Oh, now this is what I'm talking about. This laundry room is gag central. Look at the laundry supply names. Tunox, Townie, Classic.
Well, let me just say, thankfully there's no dip to be found.
What was that, Al?
Nothing.
Ooh, look inside the washing machine. It's been outfitted with two plungers. They're working away, getting Mickey's signature white gloves their whitest.
Ooh, guys, look at this broom. Hey, does this remind you of anything?
The broom from the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Way to go, Andrea. You know, this makes me wonder if this broom is still enchanted and doing Mickey's dirty work, or is it simply a prop taken from the set of Sorcerer's Apprentice that he uses for work at home?
That's a great question, Al, but sadly, I don't think it's the one with a concrete answer either. I think Imagineers left it open to our interpretation, right? Though I do like the idea of this enchanted broom coming to life and helping Mickey with the day-to-days here around his sprawling suburban house.
Imagineers really do pay major tributes to the mouse throughout this whole place, the broom being just one of the examples.
It's really interesting, too, because that broom placement further supports my idea that we're walking through a chronological look at Mickey's life.
Explain, Al.
With pleasure, Andrea. So you'll remember that the memorabilia that we looked at in the previous room focused on works from Walt and Mickey that were created in the 1930s.
Okay, yeah.
And if you remember from our very long and drawn-out aside about Fantasia, that film was released in 1940.
Got it.
So the first room represents Mickey in the 1920s, like we talked about in the first episode. The second room represents Mickey in the 1930s that we talked about in the second episode. And this broom here represents Mickey in the 1940s, as it's from the film Fantasia that was released in 1940.
Okay, Al, I was on board for a while with this idea, but this is starting to seem a little far-fetched now.
Have a little faith, Freddy. Have a little faith.
The spirit is willing, Al.
Well, then let us continue to explore. As one person I once knew told me, exploratio continua, Freddy, into the lattice tunnel, and there I will be vindicated. Oh, I will be vindicated.
This backyard is so peaceful, so serene. Such warmth and beauty with a calmness that rivals any yoga session I've ever been a part of.
And, you know, this dusky twilight in the sky really is beautiful and calming. The perfect place to find yourself a little slice of chill on a busy, bustling park.
You know, it may be arbitrary, guys, or it seems that way, but I also have a theory as to why this backyard is forever in this yellow-orange twilight.
Lay it on us, Al.
So, in photography and filmmaking, there's a concept of the golden hour, or the magic hour. The time, the time of the golden hour is somewhat fluid in its definition from artist to artist, as it occurs roughly right before sunrise or right after sunset. But it's considered the time where the light is most majestic for the lens. It's considered the perfect time for filming.
Yeah, I see where you're getting at.
Well, I'm not familiar with this concept. Can you explain further, Al?
Absolutely. So you see, Annie, here in Mickey's backyard, the timing is always perfect for making a film. It's the eternal golden hour.
Oh, amazing. What a great little detail. Which most likely gets overlooked by most everyone who walks through this area, I bet.
I couldn't agree more, Annie. Honestly, I've been walking through this house for many, many years now, and it wasn't until extremely recently that I realized that this area was constantly in a state of dusk like this.
Now, how do you know it's dusk? I mean, you yourself said that the golden hours was before sunrise or after sunset, so couldn't it be sunrise?
Well, that is a very good observation, Freddy, and I think it's a very valid argument. But there's something in the barn that I discovered during my snack exploration earlier that led me to believe that it's dusk and not dawn.
Well, speaking of the barn, there it is ahead of us.
The vibrant red is made more peaceful looking with this golden hour light. You know, oh, hey, that barn actually looks familiar.
Well, it should, Annie. It's Mickey's movie barn. It's world famous.
But the barn itself, I mean, why choose a barn? Why not a movie studio like other filmmakers?
Because a barn is pastoral?
Maybe, but I have a feeling that's not the case.
All right, Annie, now it's your turn for crazy conspiracy theories. If Al can have 50 of them in one episode, you can have a few also.
Humor me, guys. Okay, what else was created in a barn?
Ooh, Pepperidge Farm smoked sausages.
Ooh, farm fresh produce.
Me!
What?
So my parents grew up in the country. Don't ask.
Gross.
You guys, none of these answers are correct. Well, maybe the owl's creation thing, but ugh, gross. But that's not what I'm thinking of. The thing that was created in a big red barn was Disneyland.
Ah, yes.
Well done.
This barn totally reminds me of Walt's Carolwood barn that he had built in his backyard. Modeled after a barn his father owned when Walt was a child, the Carolwood barn would be the place where Walt would get away from the world and tinker with trains and miniatures. It was in this barn that Walt would devise his idea for a little train park he wanted to build up in Burbank that would eventually turn into Disneyland.
So what you're saying, Annie, is that this barn pays homage to the Carolwood barn?
Yeah, that's my theory.
Annie, I think that's genius. I think it's especially genius because it also plays into my chronology theory.
Oh, here we go.
No, not yet, Freddy. I'm going to let this one be a slow burn, a slow barn. I'm going to prove my point. I'm going to prove my point later, but for now, let's just head into the barn. Wait, but before we go, actually, I want us to look around because there's one thing that we didn't even notice here that I completely walked by, which is Pluto's little doghouse. Now, Freddy, for the last few episodes, you've had this theory that each one of the Fab Five characters shares some sort of personality trait with Walt Disney. We've covered
the pressure's on.
Yeah, right. We've covered Goofy. We've covered Donald. We've covered who else have we covered?
Goofy, Donald. We did talk about Chip and Dale.
Chip and Dale.
Yeah, even though they're Fab Five.
Yeah, but they still have some personality traits. Now I think that
and
it's
we talked about Mickey.
And it's definitely time to talk about Pluto. So give us your thoughts. What do you think is the personality trait that Pluto represents about Walt Disney?
Well, here's the thing. Walt Disney, you know, he's a farm boy. He loved his life on the farm in Missouri and really idealized that as a great time. Also grew up in Depression era and in areas of great poverty. And Pluto, in most of the early cartoons, is a mutt, a outcast. He lives out on the street. He's always being chased by the dog catcher. And it's such a sweet little character sketch of somebody who's just trying to make it by, even though the times are hard. So there's a bit of Walt in that as well. You know, he always was faced down by poverty, always just one sold cartoon away from the poorhouse, as it were. And, you know, then you could go back even further. And Walt loved animals when he was a little kid. He adored animals. He loved drawing animals. He was loyal to animals, and they were loyal back to him. And there's nobody more loyal than somebody's faithful hound. And so I always think of Walt when I see Mickey and Pluto together. You know, one is the owner, you know, Mickey being the owner of Pluto, but then you also turn that around and you can kind of see Walt in that loyal hound who, against all odds, is always there for his master.
Without a doubt. Well, I think that's a really good point, and I think loyalty, I think that it's pretty evident to see throughout Walt Disney's life. If you were loyal to Walt, Walt was unflinchingly loyal to a lot of people. Now, I think that there are relationships throughout that life and career that there was some bad blood. But you look at when you were a friend to Walt, Walt was a friend to you for life. And I was actually just watching an episode of The Imagineering Story again today, earlier. And one thing that I noticed is the Imagineering positions were always given to Walt's closest confidants at the studio, the people that he could rely on the most. And it is interesting to see that that loyalty was reciprocal. And I don't want to get political or anything like that or have any sort of commentary about the strikes that happened. But I think in Walt's own mind, you see that there was a rift in that feeling of loyalty. And there's a lot of historians that talk about how Walt put up walls after the strike. And I think that, again, this isn't political. This is a psychological analysis of Walt Disney. And I think it's because that loyalty trait there in his own mind was wounded and it was compromised, at least from his perspective, by those animators when they did the strike like that. And you can see that when somebody reacts the way that Walt did in that situation, it was very reactionary. And I think that it kind of was a tell to the fact that he is a loyal guy, and he felt like that loyalty was being challenged. So I think that that's a very, again, another real world example of this loyalty that you see inside of Pluto. And I think that that absolutely mirrors what we see in Walt.
And that loyalty was reflected back to him, you know, with folks like his nine old men or the Imagineers who went forward after he passed away. You know, they were always looking back and desiring to do for Walt what Walt had desired to accomplish in his life. And that shows up in their attention and desire to make something like the Florida Project become a reality.
Hmm. No, I think that's a great point. I think that it's really interesting because all of us as former cast members, we can all speak to this, especially because we were there during different times. But I think one of the big things that we see throughout the park is a heritage of loyalty to Walt's original vision and dream. And I think that that's really cool to see that loyalty is in this way contagious. And Pluto's a great symbol of that loyalty throughout the entire company. And it's representative of how we as cast members felt like we were guardians of that heritage, of that legacy. And again, it's because we feel that loyalty to this idea, to this magic that was created. So I think that Pluto gets overlooked a lot. But I think that, Freddie, I think that's a great insight into Walt's probably most prominent yet unsung qualities as a human being.
Yeah. And I have one more thing that reminds me, that makes Pluto remind me of Walt.
Yeah.
And that's that Pluto likes a lot of garbage food.
Yes, explain.
That's very true.
Walt loved chili and beans and Velveeta cheese, and nobody was going to take that away from him. Jell-O molds are on Walt's list of fine foods that he wants served to him every day.
Ooh,
so,
with fruit in it? Jell-O molds with
pineapple?
Yeah,
there you go. And a marshmallow.
And marshmallow.
And just a little bit of cottage cheese. Did you guys ever do that? Cottage cheese, green Jell-O, pineapple.
The highest of 1950s cuisine. Yes.
Oh,
American cuisine.
Very much so, you could find Pluto ducking his head into a garbage can, just like, I suppose, Walt. He didn't imagine he was, but he's just a man of simple pleasures. How about that?
Mm-hmm. I imagine a CEO today being like, all I want is chili beans and some Velveeta cheese over the top of it. Bring it to my room, and I'll just keep working. I mean, I don't think that happens anywhere. I think that everybody's like, I need something keto-friendly. I need a kale shot, and I need it now.
A kale shot.
It's just amazing how times have changed so much. But I do love, because, again, that's another, like you said, a snapshot into the simplicity of Walt Disney. The dude never had any sort of refined tastes, and that really played over into the park food. There's not a lot of refined
food. Oh, definitely.
Come on, dude. No, food service would be so upset with you right now. Yes.
But here's what I'm getting at is You don't have any of this frilly stuff that has a bunch of cilantro that's placed strategically on top to make it look more ornate than it is, or some sort of weird sauce when my scallop is the size of a quarter. I don't want that kind of cuisine. What I want is good old-fashioned American corn dog. And that's what I love to see inside of the park, is that simplicity of palate. And, of course, you can go to certain places, like,
dress,
I'm thinking,
up.
Yeah, Club 33 or the Blue Bayou. Or mm-hmm. someplace like that. But for us common folk, we get a good old-fashioned turkey leg that tastes like ham, and I love that.
Or a burger.
Ooh. They do have some interesting
burgers.
Yeah, yeah. And then every once in a while, when you can sleuth out a funnel cake, that's when life is great.
Why did I bring up food?
I was going to say, you guys don't want to do this to me. Don't want to do this to me. So I think that that's a great place to say, well done, Freddie. I love the thoughts that you had about Pluto. Annie, did you want to add anything before we move on into the barn?
I think also just Walt is like, Walt never lost his ability to play.
And
very cool.
Pluto and I mean all the characters are very playful, but that's something that came up for me. It's just, and I love that about Walt Disney. He reminds everyone, adults and kids, to play.
I think that's a huge, huge attribute. I love that, Andrea. Thank you for bringing it all back to the play. Speaking of play, let's go into this barn and play around a little bit. What do you guys say?
Let's check it out. Let's do it. Oh, guys. Okay, look at all these props lining the shelves in here. This is a Disney history vault if I've ever seen one. Those potatoes clearly represent the taters from Steamboat Willie.
Oh, and that drum up there, that represents Mickey's role in the short The Band Concert, one of his most influential silly symphonies.
Ooh, and on the wall in front of us is my proof for why it's eternal dusk instead of dawn. Take a look at that clock, guys.
Hey, it reads 5:03. Al, I hate to burst your bubble on this one, but 5:03 also comes around twice a day.
Three times a day in some countries.
What? Never mind. We'll deal with that later. What I'm saying is there's nothing saying that it can't still be 5:03 a.m.
Well, that might be true, but if we remember back to Mickey's to-do list at the beginning of our tour, at 5:03, Mickey's still waking up. At the very most, he's getting his balanced breakfast ready. There's no way he could be working in the barn at 5:03 a.m.
Oh, to be true, Mickey is a mouse who sticks to his routine.
And if you'll remember, quitting time for old Mick and the crew is 5 p.m. according to that list. What better time to plan a meet and greet than right after production wraps for the day? That way you get the best chance to spend quality time with the mouse himself.
Okay, Al, I have to admit it, man. This is really well thought out. Well done, sir.
Not a well done to me, Freddy. A well done to the Imagineers who clearly thought through every one of these minute details.
It is amazing to see how Imagineers have used this area to pay such detailed tribute all the way through.
Honestly, I believe a trip through Mickey's house is more of a walkthrough attraction, because a lot of people see it as just a way to wait in line. But I think that this is a genuine walkthrough, and it meets with a museum tour right in the middle perfectly.
Wow, I really never thought of this queue area in that way before. I mean, it's totally a walkthrough with a museum and a theme park overlay. Like, it's a turducken. It's a pretty genius way of sharing history without becoming too stuffy or inaccessible. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, it gets me very excited because, again, just like with a lot of our attractions in the past, when you walk through this, you take it for granted. But now that we're getting some time to actually walk through and really pore over this stuff, it makes me even more excited about Mickey's house. I couldn't agree more.
I love how Mickey still uses this barn to house a few feathered friends, keeping a portion of the barn's original function intact. He's a cool dude. Oh, that axe hanging on the wall, it's a bit ominous for those little cluckers. Ugh.
It may seem like that axe is hanging there to rub the fate of the chickens in their faces, but in reality, I think it appears to be yet another prop from The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, that's right. I always forgot about the scene where Mickey goes berserk and starts hacking up all the brooms in sight. It's kind of scary, actually.
Yeah, it is.
So really, that is an ominous axe for that poor broom prop to our left?
I guess you're right about that one. So, moving on.
A mirror. I can finally primp my beautiful goatee here in the park. Looking good, Mr. Martin. What the?
Oh, hey, you okay, Freddy?
Guys, did you see that?
Yes, Freddy, we saw how great your goatee is.
Not that, Annie, but thanks for noticing. There's a ghost in this mirror.
Come on, Freddy, don't talk about yourself that way. Age is only a number, bro.
Seriously, guys, look in the mirror.
Okay. Al, do you see anything other than our own reflections?
Not a thing, Annie. We may need to encourage Freddy to lay off the hippopotamites from Sam's for a while. I think they might be affecting his mind.
Whoa!
See, I told you. I'm not crazy.
True enough. Sorry we ever doubted you, pal.
Yeah, we were definitely visited by an image of Mickey in his sorcerer apprentice garb.
This is a super fun effect, and it's actually really simple, too.
How does it work?
Well, Annie, if any of us have ever watched even 5 minutes of CSI Miami, CSI Las Vegas, CSI Cincinnati, CSI Indianapolis...
All right.
Law and Order, any other show where there's an intense interrogation, you're always going to see people standing behind that famous pane of glass that makes up the one-way, or as some people call it, the two-way mirror.
Okay. All right. I've seen that. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, well, basically this works the same way, except that there's a really bright light over the top of Mickey. When that light turns on, the contents of what's behind the mirror shows up. But it's not just the effect that stands out to me. I can't help but notice this mirror is an Easter egg in and of itself.
I know. It looks familiar. So it's got 12 zodiac symbols around the outside edge, and the two serpents are draping down from the top on the inside bezel. Hey, this looks familiar, but where do I remember it from?
I have an idea. Okay, mirror, mirror on the wall. Tell of where you came from. Hobby Lobby? The mall?
Haha, that's it.
It came from the mall or Hobby Lobby?
No. Your little joke jogged my memory. Al, this mirror can be seen in...
Oh, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Freddy, you're right.
That's right. This is arguably the most famous mirror of the last 100 years.
Wait, this is the mirror from Snow White, where the mysterious being from the great beyond appears and speaks to the evil queen?
Indeed.
Awesome.
And totally off-brand.
What do you mean, Freddy?
Well, thus far, everything we've seen in the house belongs to Walt and Mickey, but this mirror never showed up in any Mickey Mouse cartoons or shorts.
Okay, good point.
Which leads me to wonder why it's here.
Well, that really is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Does this at all fall in line with your chronology theory, Al?
Well, I gotta say, not in a super clean or clear way. Snow White was originally released in late 1937, but went through a couple of re-releases, one of them being in 1952. This hallway has items in it that lead me to believe that this hall is the 1950s section of the chronological tour, but there are props in here from films of yesteryear, so I don't think this is a key to the chronology.
So then why is this non-Mickey-related item in here, you think?
Well, I mean, at this point, I personally can only make two best guesses off of context and history.
All right, let's hear your best guess.
Okay, so my best guess is that this mirror is a marker for a landmark moment in Walt's life. The release of Snow White marked the release of Walt's first animated feature film. This film is the thing that put him on the map, almost in equal proportions to the creation of Mickey. So, maybe this mirror is here representing two of Walt's most notable accomplishments, Mickey Mouse and Snow White?
Sounds a little shaky to me.
Yeah, to me also. I mean, honestly, this is a great Easter egg for people to find, but the continuity problems with this mirror, that it represents and presents, it's kind of rough for me.
Yeah, you're right. Everything in this house has been an ode to Mickey's career, and this just sticks out like a sore thumb.
Which leads me to my second hypothesis. So anytime we feel a sore thumb feeling in the park or in theming, it can always be tracked, or often be tracked, to...
Michael Eisner.
And that's correct, in a weird way.
Amazing how this guy did so many great things for the company, but also provided his share of problems as well.
There's no doubt about that.
But what does he have to do with this mirror?
Okay, again, this is a huge hypothesis that is most likely not true. But when I see chaos like this, I have to try to make some sense or order out of it. And here's my reach towards that order. I'm going to warn you, this is way out there. So, we all know that Michael Eisner loved Synergy, hence the name of the attraction Splash Mountain.
If listeners don't know what it is referencing, go back to the Splash Mountain episode and give it a listen.
Ooh, great plug, Annie.
Yeah, thank you.
So anyway, this Synergy could be the reason this mirror is in here. You see, as we talked about earlier, the studio was really into re-releases of films, so new generations could experience those films in theaters for the first time. But there was a very momentous re-release of Snow White that happened, and that was back in 1993. This re-release was huge because it was the first film to be scanned digitally, cleaned up digitally, and then transferred back to film. It really was a huge, huge marker in cinematic history.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So, like I said, this digital transfer happened back in 1993, and guess what else opened in 1993?
Oh, Mickey's house.
Bingo.
So you're saying that this mirror is here because Michael Eisner wanted to plug the magic of a digitally updated Snow White release?
Well, I know it sounds absurd as I say it, and it really probably is, but I mean, I don't want to discount it as out of the scope of possibility, but we do have to be careful here. We can't jump to conclusions and state that that's the true reason why the mirror exists here. Sure, some of the pieces may fit together in a really wobbly and wonky way, but as we know, that doesn't always mean it's the final truth.
Absolutely. Maybe one day we'll be able to interview an Imagineer who was part of the team that made this walkthrough and ask them about it. But until then, the inclusions of this mirror will remain a mystery.
Oh. I actually have a theory of my own, but I don't want to share it yet. I'm going to pull an owl. We need to build a little more context here before I share my theory.
Ooh, I'm on the edge of my seat, Freddy.
Me too.
All right. Onward.
Now, as we turn down this hallway, the whole area is packed with Mickey memorabilia.
The one that sticks out the most is that yellow airplane hanging from the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember from the radio production about the early history of Mickey that we listened to back on part one, that Mickey's first appearance in a cartoon was actually in a short called Plane Crazy. This plane matches the one in the short exactly.
Hey, what an awesome reference.
Thanks. And I love this stable of stars on the wall to our right here.
Oh, that stable of stars helps solidify my kooky chronology theory.
Oh, Al. How so? It's just a photo wall of the Fab Five up there.
Okay, but real quick, take a closer look at Mickey himself.
Hey, something does look a little different about him. I just can't figure out what it is.
Eyebrows.
Eyebrows?
Bingo!
The brows. Sorry.
Look, you guys, Mickey has eyebrows in this illustration.
So?
So, there really was only one time when Mickey had eyebrows drawn on his character, and that was in the 1950s.
Right on the nose, Annie.
Oh, Al, it's all coming together, and this piece of evidence totally proves it to me personally. Each section of the walkthrough really does show that this is truly a walkthrough history with Mickey and Walt.
I've got to hand it to you, pal. That's a pretty good get. I see why you are so proud of this theory. Take a brow, my friend.
Oh, thanks, Freddy.
Yes.
It took me a long time to face the reality of this discovery, but an apt pupil will always prevail.
I'm stopping it right now, guys. No pun-offs on this episode.
But
no. Nope.
You've got some nerve, Annie.
Freddy.
Sorry, I just had to get one more in.
Oh, guys, take a look over here. It looks like we got someone in the middle of painting a set piece.
Yeah, and judging by the mess, this guy doesn't walk away from this project very happy.
Or clean. Look at those footprints, or should I say, palmate prints.
Wait, monkey footprints?
No, Al. Duck prints. And it's not just any duck. My main mallard, Mr. Donald D. Duck.
I love this little feature thrown in here. It shows that the whole gang chips in to make these shorts happen.
It also proves that Donald's temper isn't just an act.
He really does have some major paint can stacking skills, though, as well.
No doubt about that. Hey, guys, we're in the home stretch here in Mickey's movie barn.
Hey, just around the bend is that waiting room where we'll wait for our meeting with Mickey himself.
Ah, but first, we'll have to walk by this thing.
What is it?
Well, it looks like some sort of all kinds of music, machiny, whiz-bangy, who-is-it-what's-it-do-hickey thingy.
Yeah, that is clearly the scientific name for it, Al. No doubt.
No, of course. Any of the finest academics.
But what is it referencing? Does this exist in one of the Mickey shorts?
Not that I've seen.
Same with me. I honestly have no idea what this music machine references.
Guys, I have to admit, I love it when I see you both stumped by something in the park. It reminds me that no matter how much someone knows about this place, there will always be more to know.
It's a very good point, Annie. I think it's the prospect of new discovery that makes every single visit to the park so thrilling to me.
I couldn't agree more. My eyes catch things I've never noticed before every single time I visit the park, which is yet another reason why Disneyland is such a unique place unto itself.
Great point, Freddy. Oh, guys, look up there. Those hats hanging outside the projection booth look awfully familiar.
Ah, yes, they do. Good eye, and those belong to our pals Goofy Goofy Goof and Donald D. Duck.
You know, these hats may seem like just a funny little reference to our two favorite Disney characters, but in reality, they had a lot more significance to the walkthrough before the current pre-show came to the theater.
Ooh, explain that, Freddy.
So back when Mickey's house opened in January 24th, 1993, there was a pre-show video that played in the movie barn. I say video, but it was really more like meant to look like a film reel playing on a bed sheet against the wall.
Yes.
And the area on the other side of the projection booth that we're about to go into. Now, the movie would entertain guests as they waited for the big meeting with Mickey himself. The short showcased all the films supposedly now filming, quote unquote, in the movie barn. Can you guess which films are being filmed in the movie barn?
Now, Freddy, how could we possibly begin to guess which movies were being made in the movie barn? There were so many Mickey shorts.
Fair enough, but I'll give you a hint. There are props that we've noticed already from each room while we walked through the house.
Okay, so I'll play along here. We saw some Steamboat Willie props on the shelf at the front of the barn.
That is one of the films they showed.
Nice one, Al. We also saw some props from the band concert short.
Ah, that's another. Two more left.
Well, we did see a broomstick from Fantasia, so maybe the Sorcerer's Apprentice?
My guys, you are on a roll.
Then I know the last one for sure. It has to be Plain Crazy.
Ah, yeah, that's right. That's right. We saw that plane hanging from the ceiling, after all.
Ah, good guess, but no.
Ooh, strike one.
Oh, and strike two and three, because I don't have any other guesses, honestly.
Yeah, me neither. Which film are we missing, Freddy?
Do you guys remember how I said earlier that I had a theory about the mirror in the barn?
Yes.
Well, here's where I fit that mirror theory in. You see, the last film in the movie barn loop was a short entitled Through the Mirror.
No way.
Yes way.
So, Freddy, are you saying the mirror is a reference to the short Through the Mirror?
again, it's hard to tell, simply because the mirror in the barn is the mirror from Snow White, not the one from the Mickey short. So, not to mention that Mickey isn't dressed up in Fantasia garb in the short like he was when we see him in the mirror.
So, it could actually be a combo of all the ideas presented about the mirror. It could be a reference to the Snow White movie to honor the release of the digital version of the film, while also being an allusion to the Through the Mirror short?
I think that it's fair to say, but again, we won't truly know unless we talk to somebody who created Mickey's house.
Again, I have to say I love a great mystery that remains unsolved.
Agreed, pal. But back to this reel that would loop inside the movie barn. Like we just established, it would feature four different trailers for the films being made here in the movie barn. But in between each trailer, guests would be treated to an original set of sequences starring Goofy and Donald as they tried to get the projection equipment to work, or at least cooperate with them. This work would result in Goofy getting in a fight with a rogue hare, you know, those little squigglies that show up in old movies?
Yes.
And it would show up in the projector, or Donald getting smashed up inside the projector itself. They were really funny.
Yeah, it sounds really fun.
Yeah, it really was, and it made those hats that are hanging by the doors up there all the more appropriate.
So, why do they not show it anymore?
Well, it had a great run. I mean, debuting in Disneyland in 1993 and then tapering off sometime in the early 20-somethings.
And what replaced it?
Well, currently the theater is showing a new batch of Mickey Mouse shorts from the Mickey Mouse television series that debuted back in 2013. Oh my goodness, has it really been that long?
Mm-hmm.
This Emmy-winning show gave an exciting refresh to the Mickey of yore, but has always been met with some criticism. But despite the criticisms, the newest attraction in Mickey's Toontown, coming soon, Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, is based off of this innovative animated series.
So, in a way, Al, this addition of the newest Mickey cartoons to the pre-show area fall directly in line with your chronological look at Mickey's history.
Good point, Annie. I think this is a good way to look at this change. Many people become cynical thinking about this change as a way to advertise the new shorts, which may well be the case, but it also fits in line with the original vision of this attraction's landmark historical walkthrough chronological feature.
Uh-huh. So speaking of making history, we're about to make history when we walk through those doors.
We just have one guest group ahead of us, and then it's our time to shine.
Can I have the next group, please?
That would be us.
Oh, are you excited to meet Mickey?
Yay! Want to hear my Mickey Mouse impression?
Oh, of course!
How you powered me, Mickey Mouse!
That was great! You have to be sure to do that impression for Mickey. Now head on in and say hello to Mickey for me.
All right, guys, we're next.
Hi, folks. I'm really sorry to tell you this, but Mickey's hanging up his ears for the night. That was our last guest group for the day. Wait, what? Al, I thought you told us we had an appointment with Mickey.
Well, guys, don't look at me. I did write him an email telling him we'd be here today, and we'd plan on meeting him around this time.
And what did he write back? Maybe you can show the cast member the email and he'll let us in to see Mickey still. I'd be happy to accommodate you guys if you still have that email.
Oh, it's the funniest thing. I never heard anything back, which is really uncharacteristic for Mickey, or so I hear.
Al, what email did you use?
This one right here, Annie. I sent an email over to him at mickey@disneyland.toontown.gov.
Al, where did you get that email address?
What are you laughing at, Freddy? I did a really official internet search on how to email Mickey Mouse. That led me to a website called Gern Blanston's Email to the Stars. I searched for Mickey's name in his database, and this was the email that I found. Now, never in a million years did I think that Gern would let me down like this. Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I was so looking forward to meeting Mickey today. I had 1,000 questions for him.
So did I.
Oh, Al. Well, this is a huge bummer.
Maybe next time don't put your hope in Gern Blanston's ability to connect you to the stars via emails. Gern Blanston? Of all people.
I mean, the name. All right, noted, Freddy. I really hosed us on this one, guys. I'm so sorry.
It's all right, pal. We got to walk through and explore every single inch of an amazing house that pays tribute to the true star of Toontown and of the Disney brand as a whole.
It was so great getting to know so much more about the life and times of this great mouse.
You guys are right, but that still doesn't make us not being able to meet Mickey in person any less rough. I was so stoked because meeting him in person shows what his latest design would look like, which gives closure to the chronology narrative throughout the entire house.
Well, we still have our mind's eye, Al.
Yeah, Al, we can just visualize him being there, and it's just like he's there.
Yeah, well, thanks for the pick-me-up, guys. You really are the best.
Before you go, I can sneak you into Mickey's green room so at least you can see where he gets ready for his films and where he meets his fans. Would you like to see that at least?
Would we ever?
All right, come on with me. This way.
Oh, guys, look at all the film cans in this room. There's like a million of them.
Well, there should be a lot of cans for a mouse that has starred in over 100 cartoons and shorts over the years. Hey, right this way. And here it is. Oh, this is awesome.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Oh, thanks so much for getting us in here, Mr. Cast Member.
Oh, please call me Eli.
In that case, thanks, Eli.
Feel free to take a look around as long as you'd like. When you're done, just head out those doors back there.
Will do. Hey, thanks again, Eli.
My pleasure. Guys, this room reveals something amazing about Mickey Mouse.
Oh, what is it, Freddy?
All right, take a look over to your left at the vanity. Human scale, right?
Right.
Now take a look at this phone, top hat, and cane. Definitely not human scale at all, right?
You're right, Freddy. They're huge, but what are you getting at?
What I'm getting at is that in all of Mickey's short films, he's the size of a typical human. It's all the props and set pieces that are exaggerated to make you think he's much smaller. At least that's how Imagineers designed this room.
What a great device to make the plausible impossible.
Oh, hey, Annie, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, of course. Walt used this phrase of the plausible impossible to explain something that can't happen in reality, but when delivered correctly, seems plausible in the real world. This room is a perfect example. It is impossible for us to meet a mouse the size of a human, but when met on his scale, it feels much more plausible. This room is where the impossible and the plausible meet.
This really is the greatest place to end this tour of the house that Mickey and the Imagineers built. I mean, this house presents the rich legacy that led the groundwork for Walt to create the happiest place on Earth, which in turn also gave Michael Eisner the power and influence to open the doors to Toontown, which then gave guests the chance to get a little history, a little mystery, and a whole heaping helping of Disney magic.
Well said, bud. Even though we didn't get a chance to meet the mouse himself, we did walk away so much better for actually slowing down and taking the time to explore the ins and outs of this often overlooked attraction.
Well, guys, I think it's that time. The rest of the park awaits.
You're right, Annie. Time to keep moving forward.
Let's do it. Oh, great. You guys are still here. Hey, you guys are really passionate about Disneyland. Maybe a little too passionate. And I was bummed to hear that your plans to meet Mickey didn't work out, but we cast members are in the business of making magic, so I was able to conjure up a little magic of my own. Come on in, boss.
Mickey!